Good morning, Your Honors. Charles DeVore for Petitioner Appellant Arthur Mitchell. May it please the Court. Petitioner presents two independent issues on appeal. First, petitioner's due process rights were violated when the state failed to correct false testimony of the lone testifying eyewitness that she was not offered an inducement to testify against him. And second, petitioner's trial counsel rendered ineffective assistance when he failed to request a second-degree murder jury instruction for provocation that was fully supported by the evidence at trial. These are independent issues. Petitioner respectfully requested this court grant habeas relief on petitioner's ineffective assistance claim, or in the alternative, remand this case to the district court for an evidentiary hearing on each of these claims. First, regarding petitioner's due process or Brady claim, this court must initially consider whether there's a bar to federal review of petitioner's claim, and if there is not a bar, whether to grant petitioner an evidentiary hearing on this claim. First and foremost, federal courts are not precluded from hearing this claim because there was never an adequate state court ruling disposing of the claim on state law grounds. But even if there had been an adequate state law ruling, petitioner satisfies the cause and prejudice exception to procedural default. Petitioner is unquestionably entitled to an evidentiary hearing here because he's made sufficient allegations that, if proven, would entitle him to relief. So first, turning to the question of the adequacy of the state law, state appellate court's ruling, the state appellate court took a totally unprecedented step when it combined two provisions of 735 ILCS 5/214.01. Those two provisions were the tolling provision, which provides that the statute of limitations for filing a 2-1401 petition is tolled if the petitioner has sufficiently alleged that the grounds for relief were fraudulently concealed, and two, that the petition must be supported by an affidavit or other adequate showing. These are two independent provisions under the Illinois statute. The Illinois Appellate Court held, and I quote, "Because he has not supported his petition with competent affidavits, petitioner has not made a clear showing that the matter he raises was fraudulently concealed. Therefore, the two-year statute of limitations was not tolled." So it's this causal language. Because he's not supported his petition with competent affidavits, he has not made a clear showing that the matter was fraudulently concealed. That was a totally unprecedented step. It is not firmly established or regularly followed practice in the Illinois courts to combine these two provisions. In our research, we could find, in fact, no case where a court combined these two provisions and required affidavits to satisfy the tolling requirement of 2-1401. And indeed, Respondents' Counsel cites no cases that combine these two provisions either. So because the Illinois Appellate Court combined these two provisions in a totally unprecedented way, hasn't happened in a case before or since, that Illinois state ruling is not was not based on a firmly established and regularly followed state law practice, and therefore it's not an adequate state law grounds to bar federal review of petitioner's Brady
claim. Can you speak to this lack of signatures on the affidavits?
Yes, Your Honor. So the affidavits are unsigned, and so for that reason, they aren't competent affidavits under the laws of any state or federal jurisdiction. The reason why they're unsigned is not firmly established in the record, but what we do know is that Sheila Mitchell, the state's lone testifying eyewitness, came into court voluntarily during one of petitioner's post-conviction hearings and voluntarily agreed to be interviewed in a side room of the court by petitioner's counsel, Eric Mitchell, and petitioner, Arthur Mitchell. Subsequent to that interview, petitioner's post-conviction counsel, Eric Mitchell, prepared an affidavit memorializing Sheila Mitchell's statements. And that draft affidavit, which, as Your Honor observed, is unsigned, included statements that she testified falsely at trial that she was not offered any inducement to testify against the petitioner. The affidavits, that interview happened in September of 2002. The affidavit doesn't have a month and a date on it, but the year included on Sheila Mitchell's draft affidavit is 2003. Petitioner's post-conviction counsel, Eric Mitchell, was permitted to withdraw from representation in January of 2004. So during the time from September 2002, when Sheila Mitchell was interviewed, to January 2004, petitioner reasonably relied on his counsel to secure a signature on Sheila Mitchell's affidavit, signifying that that she would attest to and swear to the statements contained therein. Why Sheila Mitchell didn't sign that affidavit, why Eric Mitchell was unable to secure her signature, is frankly not in the record. And that's the reason that an evidentiary hearing is appropriate here. That's the answers to those questions are knowable. While Sheila Mitchell is no longer living, as indicated in the supplemental filing that Respondents' Counsel made, she died February 2nd of 2004. Eric Mitchell, on information and belief, is still living and still is a practicing attorney in Joliet. And the police officers who initially interviewed Sheila Mitchell, during which they allegedly made some inducement for her to testify against petitioner, presumably could be called at an evidentiary hearing. Further, the police reports and the record in this case demonstrate that there was a recording of the interview of Sheila Mitchell, just as she explained in her draft affidavit. So in the affidavit that was prepared, Sheila Mitchell states that there was a recording of her interview, that the police officers switched off the recording equipment, and then told her that if she didn't testify against petitioner, that she would be charged with a crime. And then they switched back on the recording equipment and continued the interview. So the police report in this case states that there is a recording of Sheila Mitchell's interview, that was properly packaged and labeled and entered into the evidence storage facility. That recording is presumably still available. And at an evidentiary hearing, if we were able to review that recording, there may be an indication of a jump cut or an interruption in the recording that would support the veracity of Sheila Mitchell's statements, even though she's no longer around to swear to the statements. I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Has that been examined, that recording?
So my understanding in the record is that prior to Sheila Mitchell coming in and explaining this interview to Eric Mitchell and Arthur Mitchell, Arthur Mitchell's prior appointed counsel reviewed some recordings. It's not clear which recordings, whether they're recordings of the interview of Sheila Mitchell or recordings of the interview of the other eyewitness who did not testify, Janine Tanner. But there's no evidence that that recording has been reviewed subsequent to Sheila Mitchell's statement that she testified falsely. And that additional information from Sheila Mitchell would certainly be material to an analysis of the contents of that recording.
She was pretty aggressively cross-examined, though, at trial, was she not?
I don't know that I would characterize it as aggressive, but
well,
she was...
Well, brought out her personal behavior and her convictions.
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah, her drug use was brought out. Her receipt of Social Security support for mental and physical disability was brought out. That's all true. So her credibility was challenged on those bases. But the challenge to her credibility that she was actually offered an inducement to testify against petitioner wasn't brought out. And that, under the law of the Supreme Court and this court, is a fundamentally different type of impeachment and is much more powerful in the minds of the jury than the testimony that she uses drugs.
Referring back to the Illinois Appellate Court decision,
yes, Your Honor.
And the question about tolling, the opinion also speaks, does it not, to having additional 30 days to submit other evidence?
Section 214.01 includes the provision of an additional 30 days to submit evidence. But there's no argument here that that Arthur Mitchell was far beyond the statute of limitations under Section 214.01, which is 2 years. His conviction happened in 1995. He didn't learn of the basis for a Section 214.01 petition until 2002 at the earliest. So the statute of limitations should have been told at least until 2002. And instead of applying the statute of limitations and the tolling provision in the firmly established and regularly followed way that the Illinois appellate courts do in every other case, this court stepped back from that and conflated these two provisions in a completely unprecedented way. And it's that conflation, we don't need to Monday morning quarterback how the Illinois appellate court should have applied the rules regarding Section 214.01. What we need to do is look at whether that application was firmly established and regularly followed Illinois practice. And it wasn't. And for that reason, it's not an adequate bar to federal review. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. Unless there are further questions, I'll reserve.
All right. Thank you, Mr. DeFore.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Kashap?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel. I am Illinois Assistant Attorney General Gopi Kashyap on behalf of Respondent. Your Honor, Petitioner's due process claim is procedurally defaulted because the Illinois Appellate Court did rest its ruling on independent adequate state law grounds. The Illinois Appellate Court did not unexpectedly apply in tandem Section 214.01's timeliness and affidavit requirements. The application of each procedural rule was itself adequate. This is no different than if the state court had said the petitioner was untimely and that no exception applied, and then also said that the petitioner did not satisfy the affidavit requirement. But the fact that the state court declined to apply an exception to the timeliness rule because petitioner failed to satisfy the affidavit requirement does not make the procedural rulings freakish, Your Honors. At bottom, the state court declined to accept petitioner's untimely filing because petitioner made no clear showing of fraudulent concealment. That is the standard that the Illinois Supreme Court stated in People v. Coleman. It's the standard that was applied in People v. McLaughlin. So this is not a brand new thing that the Illinois Appellate Court did, Your Honors. And therefore, and instead, the Illinois Appellate Court straightforwardly applied 214.01's procedural requirements, and that is an independent adequate state law ground that bars review. Petitioner fails to show cause and prejudice to excuse his default. There's simply no evidence of cause, Your Honors. Petitioner discovered the alleged perjury in September of 2002, and so he thus had 2 years from that date to timely file a proper 214.01 petition. But even if we were to use the date that counsel discussed regarding when Eric Mitchell withdrew in January of 2004, that would make his 214.01 petition due in January of 2006, still before Sheila Mitchell had died. He had plenty of time to file, to obtain a notarized and signed affidavit from Sheila Mitchell before she died, and he did not do so. And that shows that he was not diligent. Indeed, Your Honors, the record simply does not provide any information regarding petitioner's independent efforts to obtain a competent affidavit from Sheila. We know that his family members appeared to have known her location. Sheila came to court with petitioner's sister in September of 2002. He knew her address in April of 2003. And in March of 2006, petitioner told the trial judge that his brother had just told him that Sheila had died. In the end, Your Honors, there's no external factor that impeded petitioner's ability to obtain a competent affidavit within the limitations period. And the only impediments that petitioner had claimed in the state court were grounded in post-conviction counsel's ineffectiveness, which is not a cognizable claim that can excuse petitioner's default in this court. But even if petitioner were to show cause for his default, there's no prejudice, Your Honor. As Your Honor noted, Sheila was impeached on many fronts at trial. Adding evidence that she had an incentive to testify while impeaching her further would not have undermined the physical evidence that corroborated her testimony on significant points. Sheila testified that petitioner got the bricks from behind the garage. Photographs introduced at trial confirmed that there was a pile of 30 to 40 bricks behind the garage. Sheila testified that petitioner made a football throwing motion with a brick towards Neil, who was facing petitioner. Neil suffered a laceration to his right eye. Sheila testified that Neil fell against the door. He then brought a brick down two times towards the ground, and when she exited the vehicle, Neil was face down with blood gushing from his head. The physical evidence showed abrasions and debris on Neil's face, not on the back of his head, and two lacerations to the back of Neil's head that fractured his underlying skull. The linear laceration was a quarter inch deep and 2 inches long, Your Honors, consistent with Sheila's testimony that Neil was hit with a brick. In contrast, petitioner's testimony was wholly inconsistent with the physical evidence. Petitioner said that he hit Neil over the left eye, but the injury was to the right eye. There was no foreign debris on Neil's hair or the back of his head, even though petitioner claimed that Neil fell back on his head. And the pathologist confirmed that the linear laceration couldn't have resulted from a simple fall backwards onto a gravel surface, as petitioner testified. Thus, Your Honors, petitioner fails to show prejudice and therefore cannot excuse his default. Unless this court has additional questions or would like to address the ineffective assistance claim, we ask this court affirm the district court's judgment.
Thank you, Ms. Cash. Mr. DeVore?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to just briefly address 2 points. Respondent has asserted that that the Illinois Appellate Court applied Section 214.01 in a regularly followed way. And petitioner doesn't dispute that the Illinois appellate court could have done that. It could have applied the affidavit requirement, and it could have applied the tolling requirement, each independently in a regularly followed practice, but didn't do so. So if I could just have...
You may finish.
Thank you very much. So I would just reiterate that under this court's decision in Johnson v. Foster, which cites Michigan versus Long, that even if there is a hypothetical adequate state law ground upon which the state court could have ruled, if the state court, in fact, did not reach its decision on a firmly established and regularly followed practice.
Moore, assuming that Sheila testified falsely at the trial, is there really a reasonable likelihood that the additional impeachment would make a difference in this case in light of the way the evidence played out of what she testified to and what Mr. Mitchell testified to?
Yes, Your Honor. If Sheila Mitchell, on the witness stand, testified that she wasn't offered any inducement, and then the state, as it should have, corrected that in front of the jury, there'd be, one, a demonstration that Sheila Mitchell lied on the witness stand in front of the jury, and two, a demonstration that she actually had individual incentive to testify against petitioner. And that additional incentive is meaningful impeachment testimony in the minds of the jury. That point's well supported by the case law. So I very much appreciate Your Honor's time and the opportunity on this case.
That's all right. Our thanks to both counsel and to Mr. DeVore. An additional thanks on behalf of the court for accepting this appointment.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. The case is taken under advisement. The court will stand in recess.